Thanks to all of you for joining us today. So I will be brief in my opening remarks. As you know, there was a strong reaction last week to FOMC communications, with many observers interpreting those communications as a shift to a less accommodative monetary policy. Given this reaction, and given that I've been advocating for a more accommodative policy stance, you might expect me to be concerned about the content of last week's communications. I am not. In fact, as I describe in the statement that I released today, I view last week's FOMC communications as entirely consistent with an appropriately accommodative monetary policy. But I do see the strong reaction to last week's communications as potentially telling us something important. The FOMC has communicated relatively little about its likely choice of policy actions when the recovery is more advanced. For example, once the unemployment rate has fallen below 6.5%. In this informational vacuum, it is not surprising that relatively small changes in FOMC communications can have large effects on the public's beliefs about this key aspect of the committee's reaction function. And all of our models tell us that these beliefs about longer-term policy actually matter greatly for near-term and medium-term stimulus. By providing clarity about these future policy actions, the FOMC can reduce what seems like a relatively large amount of policy uncertainty and so better achieve its dual mandate objectives. My statement that I released today describes how the committee can do so. And now I'd be happy to take your questions. Please keep in mind, though, that as always, the views that I express today are my own and not necessarily those of any other FOMC participant.
It's Mike Derby here from Dow Jones. I wanted to get your sense. I mean, you noted this strong market reaction. Are you concerned with what you're seeing in financial markets so far, and that do you think financial markets are getting ahead of themselves in terms of pricing for a monetary policy environment that you don't think is the right one to price for yet? And are you worried that markets in their current condition are going to start becoming restrictive of economic growth?
So these are good questions, Mike. Actually, what I mentioned was a strong reaction. I didn't refer to a strong market reaction. I view the market reaction as more symptomatic of the kind of reaction I saw played out in, among commentators, very close watchers of the Fed, actually, I think, had the kind of reaction that I described. The market reaction that we've seen thus far, you know, my predecessor certainly advised me not to make policy based on 1 month's data. I presume that advice also applies to 3 days' worth of data. So, you know, I think what we've seen so far is not a cause for concern, but you know, obviously, if these higher yields were to harden over a longer period of time, that would be restrictive to economic conditions and not be suppressing demand and thereby suppressing prices and employment in a way that I don't think would be conducive to the committee's goals.
Hi, this is Elon from the Washington Post. I was wondering, you mentioned that you felt that the 7% unemployment rate figure should be a threshold, not a trigger. Is it your understanding that 7% is a trigger? I think that there was a little bit of confusion, at least on my part, out of the announcement last week in terms of where exactly around 7%, you know, this action would start to occur. The chairman said in the vicinity of 7%, that could, I guess, mean 6.9% or, you know, 7.1%. So if you can kind of give clarity around how you interpret what the current guideline is, that would help us better understand where your position is.
Yeah, so I think that the way to understand it is, you know, I think the chairman articulated what the consensus of the committee is at this stage. You know, which is that we're talking about a data-dependent evolution of asset purchases. Right now, I think, you know, we're thinking about it, the committee, the chairman's remarks spoke to a gradual reduction with the program coming in around mid-2014 when the unemployment rate would, according to current forecasts, be in the vicinity of 7%. But pointing out, he would also like to see stronger growth at that point and higher inflation at that stage. You know, I don't think the committee's communication is sharp at this stage is what I have in my statement. I think my statement is putting down a stronger version of the threshold than what's in the current committee communications. And I think that's in keeping with what I'd like to see, which is more clarity about the committee's reaction function.
Now, Anna, this is John Hilsenrath. I wanted to ask you two questions. One about this call and the statement that you're putting out. It's unusual for anyone on the board or among the presidents to put out a statement and hold a conference call. So I wonder if you could explain, first of all, why you're doing this. And second of all, the chairman spoke in his press conference about the possibility that this 6.5% threshold is too high. Craig Torres asked him, and he seemed to suggest, yeah, possibly it is too high. So I wanted to hear your thoughts about what chances do you think you have of advancing this proposal that you've got to lower it?
So in terms of the first question, you know, I think the easiest way to say that is that I was concerned as about the strong reaction that I cited in my opening remarks to the committee's communications. I thought there was a sense out there that, I hate these terms, but that the committee had taken more of a hawkish turn than in terms of its thinking about policy. I thought that was a misperception that should be clarified. And I thought I was in a good position to provide that clarification because of the fact that I had been such a strong advocate for additional accommodation throughout the course of the year. So I thought I could play a useful role in clarifying what the committee has done and what can be done going forward to even enhance what we're trying to achieve.
Well, so if I could follow up on that, so you're saying you're trying to clarify the FOMC's position. I mean, are you doing this, have you coordinated with the board or with
the
FOMC?
Oh, no, absolutely, John, absolutely not. These are all my own, I'm speaking for myself. I've not talked to anybody about what to say. This is except, my staff here in Minneapolis. In terms of the second question, I've been advocating for having a lower threshold for some time, and so I was delighted to see the chairman make reference to the possibility that the committee sensed that the threshold might be lowered in the future. I thought the real to be fair to my about that, I thought the what the chairman said there was that the threshold might be lowered, but it won't be raised. And I think that's important to take away. I think what you take from my statement is the idea that lowering the threshold is about providing more clarity about what the committee is going to be doing as the economy, the recovery advances. So really lowering the threshold is really about providing more clarity about what we're going to be doing in the future. Raising the threshold would, be, I think, a big change in policy as opposed to that.
Is it fair to say that the idea is alive? This idea of lowering the threshold, is it alive and a real possibility?
I can speak for myself. It's very alive with me, John, as it has been for some time.
President Kocher Lakota, Josh Zumbrunn from Bloomberg. You said the purpose of this was to provide more clarity, but the big question in the markets right now is about tapering, what the tapering looks like, when the tapering is going to happen, and there's nothing in your statement about that. What are your views on tapering? And if the goal is to provide clarity, how can you omit kind of the main variable that people are debating right now?
Yeah, so in my statement this morning, I talked about LSAPs and the Large-Scale Asset Purchase Program as a relatively novel policy tool with uncertainty about its costs and benefits. So one way to think about this is I think of us as having two treatments that we're applying to a sick patient, the U.S. economy. One treatment is the interest rate channel, and that's a treatment we've used a lot in the past, a lot of experience with. We don't have as much available of it as we'd like. We'd like to be able to lower rates, and we can't. So another treatment we've used relatively little, and we don't have as much experience with, and we don't know how well it's going to work. We have some uncertainties about that, and it seems reasonable to use that second treatment when the patient's very sick and start to taper off as the patient recovers. And so I've marked off 7%. The unemployment rate is perhaps being well enough to stop this second form of treatment. And you could easily see tapering as you come into that 7% marker. But all of our model analysis says the actual pace of tapering is not all that important intrinsically. Now, that sounds like it doesn't jibe with what you just said about, boy, everyone's fixated on that. But why then? You know, why are people so fixated on tapering when the actual pace is not going to matter that much in terms of the economics? It's because you've said so little about something that is important in terms of the economics, and that's how we're going to behave as the economy recovers. That's what markets and public are really trying to guess at. You know, and that means any little step, no matter how trivial, is generating a lot of reaction. I think if we provide the kind of clarity that I suggest in my press release, we'll pin down the beliefs of how we're going to react over the longer haul, and that's going to provide us the freedom to taper as we wish without generating the kind of outsized market and public attention that you mentioned.
This is Alistair Bull at Reuters. Could I jump in quickly?
Please.
Your colleague, Jim Bullard at St. Louis, dissented and then issued a statement saying that he dissented because he was concerned that the Fed wasn't doing enough to defend its 2% inflation goal, and also that it had kind of acted prematurely because at the moment inflation is trending down and there's yet been no tangible evidence that the economic recovery you hope to see is in place. I mean, would you have voted with or without against the committee last week if you had a vote? And what's your view on inflation? Are you worried that it's heading in the wrong direction, or are you confident it's going to head back towards your 2% goal?
So let me take both those. How would I have voted? So, you know, I think that's a great question, a question that I didn't have to address in the meeting because I wasn't a voter. And it would have been a tough call, I will say. And it's because, on the one hand, I think that the FOMC actually did a lot of, through the remarks from the chairman provided in the press conference, announced a lot of things that were pretty accommodative. The FOMC announced that it wasn't intending to sell mortgage-backed securities. That provides more accommodation. The chairman announced that the FOMC was likely going to raise rates only gradually. That also more accommodative. And the committee also provided more details about what substantial improvement in the labor market outlook meant. That was something I highlighted in April as being a useful accommodative step, and I was really glad to see that additional clarity being provided. On the other hand, I've been advocating for some time, and in this current statement I did do it again, and I do feel strongly that it would be useful for the committee to provide more guidance about how it's likely to react as the recovery advances further. So what's going to happen once unemployment falls below 6.5%? So there's a tension between those two things. There is more accommodation being provided in what the committee communicated last week. On the other hand, there's still more to be done. And so would you deal with that as a voter? That's something I didn't have to deal with last week. I will have to in 2014.
And on inflation, sir?
Oh, sorry, yeah. So on the inflation front, you know, I have marked my inflation outlook, I would say, maybe by 0.1 or 0.2 since the beginning of the year. That's conditional on a particular course of policy. And I've been concerned that inflation has not been returning as fast a target as I would like for some time. You know, we have an inflation goal of 2%. We should be taking actions to facilitate the return of that. I would say within a 2-year time horizon, we should be willing, I think, as long as unemployment is as high as it is, to adopt policy stances which would allow inflation to rise above 2%. So with all that in mind, I've been advocating more accommodation. But I think the right way to provide that extra accommodation is through providing this additional clarity about what we're going to be doing during the course of the recovery. I think that's what markets are and the public are really craving in terms of providing more certainty and clarity about what the committee is going to do. And that's the kind of policy measure I've been advocating for some time. That's to put both upward pressure on employment and upward pressure on prices.
Hi, this is Steve Goldstein from MarketWatch. I just wanted to ask, we were talking about bond buying and low inflation. I mean, there seems the Fed has always said that if, you know, inflation were to get too high, that they could curtail bond purchases early. But I've wondered, what about that process in reverse? If inflation is too low, would they continue them longer than the unemployment rate would otherwise suggest? So if we're under 7%, but inflation is still down around 1%, is that reason to sort of rethink what we're doing?
So, we want to be careful not to, the only thing I'll correct you on there, Steve, is that, it's about the outlook always, right? It's not just about where we are today. It's looking forwards, what's inflation going to be doing. But certainly, I talk about a 7% unemployment rate threshold in my for asset purchases in my statement. If you get to that 7% unemployment rate threshold and your outlook for inflation is subdued, it's going to take several years to get back to target. I think that certainly would argue for continuing or expanding asset purchases. I'm speaking for myself. I'm not talking about I can't say for sure what the committee would do in those circumstances. But certainly appropriate monetary policy, my thinking would be that if we got to that 7% unemployment rate threshold and looked at economic conditions, one of the things we'd be looking at is our inflation outlook. And if that was running subdued, then that would certainly be a reason to be thinking about continuing or expanding the asset purchase program.
Hi, this is Craig Torres from Bloomberg. I wanted to ask, so what is the communication problem in your view? I noticed this morning that December 14 Eurodollar futures, a proxy for the federal funds rate perhaps, have done nothing but go up. And I thought it was pretty clear that that the committee was aiming for an increase in 2015, and yet the financial markets seem to think an increase in the benchmark rate will occur earlier. So I'm puzzled as to what more you could do to communicate it. What do you think needs to be done?
Well, great question. I think the communication is really critical this early around, and we're still, I think, learning about how to do it in the most effective way. I would say that there is a couple of things that we could be doing, though. One of the phrases that I think is critical in helping understand our policies is in the FOMC statement, and it's. But I think, as you press guys like to say, I think we buried the lead on this. So if you go to the fifth paragraph of the FOMC statement and the second clause of the first sentence, this is the critical thing that's supposed to guide our policy as the economy recovers. And it says the committee expects that a highly accommodative stance of monetary policy will remain appropriate for a considerable time after the asset purchase program ends and the economic recovery strengthens. We have to bring that forward and hammer it every time we talk about policy, that's our guiding principle when we think about what we're going to be doing going forward. So that's communication is, you guys are writers, communication is about emphasis as much as what you're doing. And this is an important phrase we should be emphasizing. And, as I said, it's in the fifth paragraph, second clause of the first sentence. I think that we really have to do what we can to provide more certainty further out in terms of the recovery. And I think we do have to explain more clearly why it is. And this is what I think this is the tough part about the communication. Why is it that you're going to be tapering purchases in advance, so far in advance of normalization of recovery? And the answer is because of these uncertainties we have both in the cost and benefit sides of the asset purchase program is leading us to taper them off, taper our second treatment before the patient is fully well. That makes sense from an economics point of view, but it makes the communication challenging because of the fact that you're going to be tapering this one program, but still in the business of providing lots of accommodation through your first and better-known treatment of the low-interest rate program. I think that we have to get better at the communication front. It's on us to do a better job. How can we do a better job? I think by highlighting what we're trying to achieve and how exactly our steps we're taking are helping us achieve those goals. And what we're trying to achieve, I think, is really nicely phrased in that clause that I highlighted earlier.
This is John Hilsenrath again. It seems like every time the Fed either stops or talks about stopping a QE program, the markets turn down. Two-part question. Is the market telling you right now it's just not that the economy just isn't ready to even be thinking about taking this away? That's A. And B, are the critics of the QE policies, are they right when they say that, the Fed is giving the market this medicine that it's become hooked on?
In terms of that first question, John, in terms of why is quantitative easing getting so much attention? You know, if you remember back to Jackson Hole last year, Mike Woodford talked about some of the ways that quantitative easing affects the economy. And one of the ways it affects the economy is it's really the flow, the decisions we make about that are viewed as a signal about our reaction function. And I think this is the theme of really of what I'm trying to communicate today is the reason that the markets are focused on our flow of purchases, in part, there's definitely an economic contribution being made by that, and I'll come back to that in the second part of your question. But a lot of what I think what people are hung up on is thinking about that is what is it saying about the way the Fed is going to react down the road? You know, what's it going to do when it's as the economy improves, when the unemployment rate falls back down to 6.5%? We have to be nailing that down, providing more certainty on those points. And if we do that in a more effective fashion, I think we'll alleviate mitigate the issue you're describing, where markets have been as sensitive as they have been to reports about the future of the program. In terms of the second. I never understood this drug analogy. My own analogy is one that I have in my head is the one that I described in this addiction analogy, which is, I guess, popular among some people. I think of us as providing a coat for the economy. It's still wintry conditions. I know it feels like it should be May by now. We should be able to take off the coat. But, you know, we well know in Minneapolis that doesn't always happen, and you should keep your coat on when it's cold out. LSAPs are providing support to the economy. How does it do it? By buying longer-term assets, we put downward pressures on yields in the marketplace that makes spending today by both businesses and households more attractive, and that'll generate economic stimulus. So I've never understood the addiction analogy that is popular in some quarters.
This is Heather Scott with M&I. If I could just follow up a little bit on that issue, the previous question rather, you're advocating for more clarity on policy, but are you saying then you don't think you need to provide more clarity on the trajectory of the asset purchases?
Well, I think if you look at my statement, I think that that I issued this morning, I try to provide more clarity. I think that the clarity I provide is that we will be in the business of buying assets at least as long as the unemployment rate exceeds 7%. Now, I think this kind of clarity exceeds what has been provided so far. It's consistent with the statement so far, but there is more clarity in what I've articulated. So think about, in particular, suppose there were adverse shocks that affected the economy that slowed down the return back to 7%. And we stayed at 7% through mid-2015 as opposed to the expectation now that we'll be down there closer towards the middle part of 2014. Well, if the committee has adopted a 7% unemployment rate threshold for the purchase program, the purchase program will continue to provide accommodation as long as the patient is so sick. As long as the unemployment rate is above 7%, we're going to be in the business of providing the extra accommodation through the asset purchase program. So I think that my statement does build on and enhance existing communications from the committee to provide helpful clarity.
Right, but the committee hasn't done that so far.
No, absolutely not. The theme of what I'm saying is that there's ways to build on existing committee communications to provide even more clarity about what we're planning to do in the future. That enhancement of clarity would, I think, be very beneficial in terms of our pursuit of our dual mandate objectives.
I wanted to ask, is Mike Derby again. You say you're doing this of your own volition. There are 11 other Reserve Bank presidents, some of whom are pretty hawkish and are uncomfortable with the kind of policy that's being pursued right now. They presumably could offer up their own, something similar, do exactly what you're doing right now. And if they were to do that, it seems like the communications process could get even more muddled than it is right now. You'd have a lot of different messages out there. Are you at all worried about that sort of environment?
You know, I think this is a committee of different people, and you know, people are certainly going to express their own views about the course of policy. My message is, I think, a little more nuanced than that, though. It's simply that I saw the interpretation of what the committee did in a lot of quarters is saying that the committee had taken a hawkish turn. My message is simply that the committee communications that we had last week are completely consistent with the kind of appropriately accommodative monetary policy that I've been advocating all year. What needs to get that extra accommodation into committee communications then would be the kind of enhancement of clarity that I'm describing.